keep it alive. Through these lines I write, I keep it live, cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here, holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling. When you feeling them flares, they can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch the scenario, my stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah. Just nod your head with it, so explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it, no scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool, hear my heartbeat beat into the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so, no overdose cause it's dope, yo. Man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow, down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd know we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock, like I told you. I'm doing this for dreams we pursue.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio Show. Once again, with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV and the antimedia.org/radio. Really happy to be back and alive in these crazy, insane times. So many big news stories today, man. It was just on fire today with things going on. Of course, here domestically with the Electoral College drama, or drama that never was, at least from a Democratic standpoint. We're going to be talking about that. Very, very big assassination in Turkey today with the Russian ambassador. We're going to be talking about that. And, you know, again, more just attacks going on around Europe, and the U.S. embassy lockdown in Turkey, CIA and their relationship with the Washington Post. That's probably the must read of the day over on the antimedia.org in-depth investigation by our awesome editor. The Washington Post is not being honest to people. That's the thing. And they're out here throwing these accusations around about the CIA and this, that, and the other, the, you know, Russians that have hacked the election, and, you know, in retrospect, it's hilarious, because after today and the Electoral College non-drama from the Democratic side, it's like, okay, no one believed any of the shit that came out anyway, so does it really matter? But the thing is that, you know, the Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, which is the same guy that owns Amazon, which is the same company who has a $600 million contract with the CIA. And so when the Washington Post goes around reporting on stuff that the CIA is telling them, well, they should at the very least do their readers the justice of saying, hey, look, you know, we do have a conflict of interest. The CIA pays our owner a lot of money. So, you know, therefore, you know, at the very least, give us a little disclosure here so people can know, okay, maybe there's a little bias, or maybe there's some conflict of interest here. But they don't. They don't say anything. They don't even bother mentioning it. It's just one of those things. It's just, oh, why even tell us? You know, why tell the people? But they're sitting here telling us that the CIA is telling them stuff without giving us any proof, and we're supposed to just believe it. And they're trying to get politicians to act on it. They're trying to get the Electoral College to act on it. They're trying to get the American people to not believe in the integrity of the election. And on that front, I'm in agreement. The integrity of our elections aren't legit. I mean, look what happened to Bernie Sanders and the Democratic primary. That was not legit. The integrity is not there. The election should have been redone. At least the Democratic primary should have been redone. And then maybe we'd have a much different outcome right now, because we'd be looking at the Electoral College probably electing maybe Bernie Sanders instead of Donald Trump. I wasn't a Bernie Sanders fan, but being fair is fair. When someone cheats your election, you know, maybe you should have a redo or something. But anyway, you know, everyone's familiar with the narrative that Russia hijacked the election, tried to elect Trump. No proof has been given, really. And so, again, it's just fake news coming from the media, while at the same exact time they're accusing us of peddling fake news and accusing a bunch of people in the independent media. Now, don't get me wrong. There's a bunch of fake news out there. If you go to yournewswire.com and go look at what they have, it's like fiction. Go look at Veterans Today, and it's like a plot of the TV show 24 or something. It's like fiction. There's fiction. There's fake news out there. There's satire out there. If somebody has to tell you at this point that The Onion is satire, it's like, you do not belong on the internet. Get off the internet and go back to whatever it was you did before. Go thumb through a library or something. Because the internet, that's the beauty of it. It's the Wild West of the information age. We don't have to have our information blended up and served to us in the form of baby food anymore by CNN. We don't need that. I mean, give it to us raw. Let us see the information. Let us see your evidence. Let us see your opinions. And that's what we're all about. We're not spreading fake news. I mean, in the past year on the anti-media, I mean, we're coming up on 2017. We've probably had to retract maybe, I don't know, 5 stories. But we're posting 5 to 10 stories a day. You know what I'm saying? So retracting 5 stories, and unlike the rest of a lot of the mainstream media, when we post a retraction, we actually issue an update or an apology, like, hey guys, we got it wrong this time. Sorry, we'll try harder next time. We're not trying to peddle fake stuff. But maybe 5 times this year we messed up and posted a story that wasn't correct, and we retracted it 5 times. Does that mean we're a fake news outlet working for the Russians? Well, according to the Washington Post, it does. But the Washington Post is a fake news outlet apparently working for the CIA. You guys got to go read this article on the anti-media, because it runs really deep. I mean, the relationship between the CIA and the Washington Post is, you know, this whole Jeff Bezos, you know, $600 million contract, that's like the new stuff. This stuff goes back to the 50s. The Washington Post has been a mouthpiece for the CIA since the 50s, man. This is, you know, this is fake news 101. The CIA wants fake news going out there to influence our opinion. Do they want to overthrow a government in Guatemala? What do? They plant fake news in the Washington Post and in the New York Times. That's what they do. So go read that story. We're not going to go too far in depth. It's such a big story, though. I may invite our editor, Carrie, onto the show on Wednesday to talk about it, because it's the rabbit hole here is deep, and it goes far beyond just the Washington Post. So anyway, I recommend everyone go check that out. Anyway, that being said, let me introduce my co-host, DB Schwartz. What's up, man? How you doing tonight?
Hey, you know, I don't know how deep you go down rabbit holes, Nick. Maybe not as deep as I do, but I mean, what's going on today is so predictable, with the electoral vote basically confirming what happened. I think we all understand now that what you're saying, the Washington Post, their owners, you know, take their orders from the people that lost. And the people that lost, this was their last hurrah, their last, we can still do this, so we want to negotiate our surrender, dude. I mean, in all likelihood, today was the last hurrah for many, many, many people that work at the CIA and many alphabet agencies. A lot of people took retirement today. A lot of people are on planes on one-way tickets to South America or other places where there's no extradition. Believe it. And these 3 events, and maybe there's some more to come for the next month, they're all just, you know, a big show and a big threat. We can do more. We can make something huge happen if you guys don't let us go. And ultimately, you know, it's going to come down to whether or not this these pedo rings get totally devolved and get broken up and taken out, because if they do, a lot of these people aren't going to be able to escape no matter where they go. It'll be like a Nuremberg trial type thing that I think is building up, dude, honestly. So I don't know, man. I don't think you can be happy today, but at the same time, there's some people that may get their due finally.
Very interesting stuff. So first I want to talk about what went on in the Electoral College today, because first let's give some backstory here. You know, the mainstream press has been in overtime, and Hillary Clinton, John Podesta, and a bunch of other Clinton surrogates who are definitely kind of the exposed neocon, neoliberal establishment now at this point, were coming out hard, and they were just trying to push for this, you know, electoral college coup, as some people were calling it, to say, okay, you guys, you know, Trump is unfit to be president, so you guys, you know, all you people in the electoral college need to come to your wits, and you got to vote for Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump. And so that was the big question this morning. It's like, okay, well, everyone's going to watch and see, is the electoral college going to, you know, go against what they've done in, you know, historically, and break party lines and go vote for Hillary Clinton instead. This is, you know, some Democrats still were holding out hope, like, oh, maybe it'll happen, you know, maybe Clinton will still be president. So I was watching this stuff today, and I wrote an article over on the Anti-Media. First official Electoral College defector dumps Hillary for Bernie. And this, I ran across this story from The Hill, and I was laughing for like 10 minutes straight. I literally couldn't stop laughing, because it was just to me the biggest slap in the face for the mainstream media, for the Clinton establishment, for all the neocons and neoliberals that were still holding their bets on this. You know, like I said, huge propaganda campaign to get the Electoral College to defect, blah, 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 blah. The first person to defect in the Electoral College went against Hillary Clinton and voted for Bernie Sanders. You know, and this to me was just, it was just like, oh my God, this is just the most hilarious thing I've ever seen. I couldn't believe it. And that wasn't the only one. In fact, I had to update my article, because as time went on, more and more defections came. And it turns out that four electors from the state of Washington defected from Hillary Clinton. Three of them voted for Colin Powell, which I don't know where that came from. It came out of left field. One of them voted, I found this one really interesting, voted for Faith Spotted Eagle, a Native American leader from North Dakota who was involved in the fight against Dakota Access Pipeline. That, to me, was pretty cool. A elector from Colorado was removed from his position after voting for Hillary Clinton. And then a elector in Maine cast a vote for Bernie Sanders. The vote was later overturned, as well as the one from Minnesota, which also went for Bernie Sanders. Now, there were two defections from Donald Trump, but neither one of them went to Hillary Clinton. This was also really interesting. One of them went to John Kasich, which was arguably the most electable Republican running in 2016, who probably would have, you know, Trump beat Hillary Clinton, Kasich would have, like, completely smashed her. But one of them went to Ron Paul, and that was pretty cool, because, you know, many people listening know that I was someone who supported Ron Paul back in 2012, and I still think he has some really good insights on foreign policy and civil liberties and the drug war and different things like that. I value his commentary on political events and things like that. So it was really interesting that Ron Paul gained a electoral vote this year, and that one stood. It wasn't overturned, so that went into the records, and Ron Paul got that vote. You know, and this is what's funnier, is that Ron Paul ran for president in 2012. He didn't get any electoral votes, so he didn't even run this year, and he won a vote. In fact, it makes Ron Paul, I think, the most successful libertarian candidate, even though he's not a candidate in U.S. history, basically, at least in modern political history. So that was very interesting. Ron Paul got more electoral votes than Gary Johnson and Jill Stein combined, which was one. So, I mean, very, very interesting stuff. I mean, DB, I know you've been following this closely. What do you think of this Electoral College stuff today?
Oh, man, I don't know, dude. I mean, here's the thing. Like, if the shift happens like we've been talking about and like we think it has, like, what are these guys going to do except do, like, maybe one or two lone protest votes, make the constituents happy? Texas is a huge state. They could break off from the union anytime. They have that agreement. So it's it's actually nice to see Ron Paul get a vote. It truly is. And also to see Bernie get one, even though he had to get it taken back because Hillary can't even lose gracefully. So
yeah, he got that too. Returned.
Yeah, they made him. They pressured him to return it. So it's here's the thing, man. Nobody wanted her. They probably doctored half of the votes if people even showed up. Half the people were dead. Half the people probably couldn't even legally vote. I mean, nobody wanted her. This was a coup d'état that was counter-couped silently under threat of force. These were bankers that were told, "We don't give a shit if you do a reset on the global economy. We'll make sure you and your families disappear if you do something stupid like that." And I think also, Nick, what happened was the NSA actually supplanted as the new top. So they now have eyes everywhere, including the people that spy. So they're spying on the people that spy. So you can imagine how much ungodly power they have, and it's all stored away and based in cloud servers that are all on dead man switches. So Julian Assange had a dead man switch. Imagine what NSA guys have. I mean, you're talking about the power structure changing probably in the last decade because of the advances in surveillance tech. So I don't know where you go with that, man. I think what we saw right here was a military coup. Military intelligence took over for the alphabet agencies. It swept them out and said, "Get the hell out of here. We have proof. We will take you down or we will take you out. Take your choice."
Major shift underway. And I want to go back to this commentary on the media here, because you know, with all this pressure, and not only that, but there was a bunch of petitions circulating that were being also talked about by the mainstream media about this, you know, petitioning electors to, you know, cast their vote for Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump. And this got a lot of media coverage: ABC News, NBC News, Huffington Post, Washington Post, New York Times, all of them were on board with this. Not a single elector defected from Trump to Hillary Clinton. Now, there were two electors that defected from Trump, but they didn't go to Clinton, as we talked about. And there's several electors that defected from Hillary Clinton. But I got to ask the question at this point. Is the media talking to itself now? I mean, is the Washington Post literally just reporting for other quote-unquote journalists in the mainstream liberal media? Is that the point that we've gotten to? Because obviously none of that stuff had an effect on the Electoral College. None of them defected from Trump to Hillary. You know, and the people I read in a recent survey, which was also reported on The Hill, that the majority of voters in the U.S. do not believe that Russia had a impact on the presidential election. Despite all of this narrative about Russia, 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 Russia did this, Russia did that, and everybody agrees that Russia tried to help Trump, the people aren't believing it. In fact, the only people that believe this are like hardcore Democratic partisans. That's it. And not even all of them believe it. The majority of the country does not believe this Russian narrative. You know, and so this to me gave me just the ultimate satisfaction today, seeing that this, you know, full court press about trying to get these Electoral College people to switch over to Hillary Clinton. Now, let me just throw this out there. I am not a fan of Donald Trump. In fact, I've been one of the biggest critics of Donald Trump. But I have to admire the fact that people are no longer listening to the Washington Post and the New York Times for reasons that I talked about briefly earlier about, you know, just the horrible collusion going on. And in the article I wrote today about these Electoral College voters who defected from Hillary to Bernie, it goes back to the treatment of Bernie Sanders. And if we're going to talk about electoral rigging and people getting in the way of the electoral process, well, we need to look no further than the Democratic Party, the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Donna Brazile, CNN. I mean, all of these people got in the way of the democratic process. Like I said, if the democratic process were to have been treated fairly in the primaries, there's an extremely good chance that we'd be the Electoral College would have been casting their votes for Bernie Sanders today instead of Donald Trump. And so the thing that is both troubling and also inspiring to me is that what's troubling is that the Democrats are blaming everybody, and they're actually pushing to the point where they're advocating censorship as far as, you know, censoring news stories that may be critical of the Democratic establishment or the political establishment in general. And we're seeing that manifest at this point with this new Facebook, you know, fact-checking thing that's going to be run by Snopes and ABC, and in the Washington Post, of course, is part of the coalition that's going to be fact-checking people, the Washington CIA Post. We're seeing that they're willing to go to the as far as advocating censorship. Now, the thing that is encouraging to me is that the Democratic Party, being that they're unwilling to accept defeat or to learn from their defeat or say, you know what, we messed up, we shouldn't have done that to Bernie Sanders, we understand that maybe that's the new direction that we should be taking the party and we're going to embrace that, and we're next election we're going to fold a bunch of young people into the party by embracing maybe some more progressive ideas and stuff like that. They're not doing that, and that to me, as maybe backwards as it sounds, it's a good thing, because we need to do away with these parties. The Democratic Party needs to go away. It needs to be extinct. It needs to be broken up into several pieces, and they could, you know, the old, whatever's left of the Democratic Party can join up with the neocons, and they can make their own third party. And maybe what's, you know, maybe the progressives in the Democratic Party can form a coalition with the libertarians, and maybe they could bring a viable challenge in the next election from a third party. You know, who knows? But keeping the system as it is, where you got Republicans and Democrats who basically agree on everything. Now, I'm not talking about the neo-fascist Trump wing, the neo-nationalist Trump wing of the party. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about the old, you know, the neocon Republicans, the neoliberal Democrats. They have so much in common. Like, literally, they agree on all the extremely important policies, and they disagree on, like, abortion and, like, gay marriage and stuff like that.
It's so, like, stuff the government shouldn't have a say in, Nick?
Exactly. Stuff the government shouldn't be doing anyway.
Isn't that the ultimate bait and switch that they've managed to do on us? They've managed to get us to argue over things that actually don't matter, while they're combined together in their efforts of things that actually make our lives worse every single day.
It's crazy, man. It's crazy. I mean, the war in Iraq, which has basically led us down this horrible cycle of events that has turned into the war on terror and a perpetual war all around the world that we're engaged in, and was massively expanded under Obama. That was a bipartisan affair. Now, if you look back towards the end of George Bush's second term, you'll see that there was a very organic, progressive movement that started splitting apart from the Democratic Party, saying, hey, you know what? We need to stop these wars. We need to hold these politicians accountable. We can't allow for these executive orders. We can't allow for this spying, you know, the Patriot Act and all this stuff. Like, that was a legitimate movement back in 2006, 2007, 2008. That's how Obama got elected. The problem was Obama absorbed that movement and then diffused it, and then all those people went back to sleep, and then Obama became George Bush 2.0.
And Clinton did that for Bush, the senior. And they do that back and forth, back and forth. And what's to stop people from thinking that it's the same way this way? Well, the difference being is that it was like all the neocon party, whereas Trump's just like, who the heck? No one even knows. I think basically what we have now is the military party. I think that's what we're going to gear ourselves towards. And I don't know, man. If we actually pull back from wars and come home and maybe, I don't know, build our infrastructure instead, that would be good for national defense.
Yeah, something different, right? Something's got to give. And so there's a very organic... there's a couple of very organic movements going on in the United States, and whether they're going to be tapped into politically or just simply absorbed is yet to be seen. So first of all, you've got the progressive movement that elected Obama, It still exists. And that was the same movement that was propelling Bernie Sanders. It's still there, and I think it's pretty much a permanent progressive class. Now, it can be co-opted like Obama did, but it's still going to be there, and over time, eventually it wears off where it's like the spell of Obama finally wore off, and they're like, all right, we need someone even more progressive. We need Bernie Sanders, and that's where Bernie Sanders got his movement. And that's why Hillary Clinton had no enthusiasm. That's why nobody was really excited about Hillary Clinton except for my 60-year-old aunt that's been a Democrat for 45 years. I don't even think that math makes sense, but still, you know what I mean.
Would she have been excited if Hillary wasn't running and instead, like, say Hillary got sick and then she's like, I'm handing the reins over to Tim Kaine. Everyone still vote for this guy. I mean, we know the wave Hillary rode in on, and she turned out to be god-awful to be able to lose. Riding the wave for people that wanted change for the first woman president, she was just that bad.
Horrible. Horrible. Horrible to the point that she couldn't gain one electoral vote. And they did a recount in those states, and I think she lost votes. She lost votes.
She lost in Wisconsin for sure.
Oh man, it's ridiculous, dude. Just horrible, horrible candidate. I mean, it makes you almost think the Democrats were trying to lose on purpose, but it doesn't. Judging by their reaction, it doesn't seem like they were trying to lose on purpose. They just thought they'd be able to trump with their media coverage and their collusion and all that stuff. It didn't work. And because Trump kind of called out the electoral rigging stuff like preemptively, they couldn't, you know, I'm not saying that they were going to do that, but maybe that was part of the play, and they couldn't do it because people were going to be looking at that stuff too closely, and so they had to back off that, and they just had to let it go, and they were like, oh, hopefully all of our media coverage will still elect Hillary. Didn't work. The people in this country do not like Hillary. She is an unlikable person. She is, like, Bill Clinton, not a huge fan of Bill Clinton, but the guy is a brilliant politician. I'd have voted for him. If I was a voter, I'd have voted for Bill Clinton over Trump. But first of all, I'm not a voter. Second of all, Hillary Clinton is just so goddamn unlikable that nobody can get excited for voting for her. Nobody. And it shows now with this Electoral College stuff, despite all the media coverage, despite all this, like, Trump, 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 Russia, 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 nobody buys it. Nobody. That's a good thing because we're tired of letting these guys choose our shit. Now, the bad thing is that now Trump is going to be the president, and he's a xenophobic neo-nationalist that is basically part of, like you said, DB, a legislative military coup that who knows how in the hell it's going to turn out. Probably not good. Maybe a little bit better than what would have happened under Hillary Clinton, but still not good.
Well, I think, like, in a worst case scenario, we would have went to war with Russia under Hillary, and then because that's such an enticing thing to do, China would have just gang piled on us, and I think American life as we know it would have just completely collapsed under the weight of the other two beating up on us. We're just seriously not nobody's prepared for that. But if we actually ally with Russia, which I believe is going to happen despite what happened today, I just think it's a natural progression among the two militaries that they realize, like you've been saying for years, China's the real threat. Like, maybe Russia can do some damage, but honestly, if we have to handle China solo, it's going to be really, really hard. And maybe if we ally with Russia, we can kind of contain them and keep this world at least multipolar, because China's got so many people and their technology is just leaps and bounds accelerating. And I mean, how long do you think it'll take them to catch us? 5 years? Maybe. I mean, they're working night and day, so we've got to have some balance in the world somehow.
China is so big and so much more powerful than anybody else in that region, including Japan for now. Now, as we've talked about in recent shows, Japan is remilitarizing, and in a decade from now, we're going to be looking at a whole new picture. And it all depends on what happens between now and then. But China is so big that without a counterbalance, it could absorb like every other country in Asia right now. And Asia is probably the most densely populated area in the world, man. If China were to absorb the rest of Asia, that's like probably around half of the world's population. And then what? Then who's going to put them in check? And you're right, man. I mean, the only chance to keep some type of balance going, because the United States is quickly losing its monopoly as the superpower. China is already considered a superpower at this point, and they're quickly going to surpass us on many, many different fronts, including economic, which in by some measures they've already passed us up.
And Nick, I truly believe we could have a balance, because I don't think that China wants, they would necessarily go, you know what, we have our eyes on Australia, we're about to grab that. Like, I don't believe China, if China had ever at any point wanted to become an empire, they would have. They're 7,000 years old. They've had so many famines and so many civil wars that the people there, they look at war and all that stuff as absolute last resort. And because they've gone through like complete huge genocides. I mean, there was a civil war after Mao where I believe 175 million people died. That number is so staggering. That number made World War II look like peanuts. World War II is like 40 or 50 million. So more than three times as many people died just within China after World War II because of Mao, because of the communist revolution, which was really us supplanting the nationalist government and basically coming in and controlling it. You know, we still owe China, I don't know how many millions of tons of gold that we supposedly were storing for them so that Japan wouldn't take it during the World War, and we never gave that back to them. That was supposed to actually hit, believe it or not, September 12th, 2001, and a lot of people always say, well, isn't that convenient? So there's a lot of posturing going on, but ultimately, man, we need to have at least unilateral balance. There's got to be like a bipolar world. Because otherwise, what are we going to have, Pax China or Pax Americana? Do either of those things sound good to anyone else listening around the world? They don't to me.
Yeah, and you know, that's the thing, is that there needs to be balance. And you know, for the time being, there's going to be super states and there's going to be superpowers. There's nothing really we can do about that for now. And for the time being, we need to buy our time. And you know, we talked about this last show. Buy our time and keep developing good ideas and good technologies so that we can start shifting towards decentralized governance, self-governance over time, over the next decades and millennia. We can become a earth where we don't need super states and empires that oppress people and start huge wars and genocides and all kinds of crazy things that go on nowadays. We don't need that anymore once information and technology is freed up and accessed by people all around the world. So we can do better. We can do better things. We can start, you know, exploring the universe and stuff like that instead of killing each other.
And we don't need to be one world necessarily to explore space. Like, you could have people that are in comfortable unions of cultures. Like, we don't need to all blend together and force each other to be, you know, mixing peoples that don't want to. You know, America's a place where it's kind of like been this I guess experiment to see if it would work, and by and large it's got a major amount of problems, but it kind of works because diversity is its own strength. It comes with a lot of problems, but it's its own strength. But you know what, China is, you know, pretty homogenous. Japan's pretty homogenous. They compete with us, so there's a strength to having a culture that's unified as well, where everyone's kind of in that same mission or goal in life. So there's either way you can look at it. You know, we don't need to have a new world order and a one world government. It doesn't need to happen. We could go to space. Japan could go to space. China could go to space. Russia's already there. And India's right on the cusp. And if the EU really, really wanted, the EU would actually be the superpower of the world if they ever actually became the EU, which Brexit destroyed. So and we don't need to become a one-world government.
And who are the ones that are the closest to getting people to Mars right now? It's not
probably government. Us and China and Russia, but I would guess that it's probably China's probably ready to do it more than we are.
But Musk is closer to getting people to Mars than any government is.
Yeah, you're right.
So here's the lesson here, and I think that people need to consider. We don't need a super state like China saying, look, all 1.5 billion of our people, we're going to tax the shit out of you so we can go colonize Mars. How about this novel idea of saying, hey, anyone that thinks it's a good idea that we should start getting to Mars, how about we crowdsource, and whoever thinks it's a good idea can pitch in and we can start sending people over to Mars. And that's genius. What Musk is doing, you know what I mean? We don't need super states to come through and heavy-handedly tax the shit out of people and take their money because we want to go to Mars. What if I don't want to go to Mars? What if I'm a person that says, I don't want to go to Mars. I want to just deal with what we have here. We don't need empires to go do that kind of stuff and reallocate resources. We have the information available now where we can voluntarily say, yeah, I think that's a good idea. I'll fund that. We don't need these super states, but again, we're stuck with them. We're going to be stuck with them for a while. We need to survive them and evolve past them. And so, what we don't need anywhere in the near future is World War III. That's what we don't need. We don't need a big giant war where a bunch of people die, because nowadays it's not like World War I or World War II where it's like, okay, we drop bombs on cities, we light cities on fire. Now it's like we destroy entire countries with weapons of mass destruction. It's not a scenario where, who knows what could happen, but a lot of people, maybe the majority of the Earth's population, could perish in a World War III situation. And that's not something that we need to do. That's not something that we should be doing. And we don't, we could feed the world's population how it is right now with the embrace of innovative farming technologies and stuff like that. We don't need to have a major war wipe people out just because two governments disagree with each other.
Nick, I was reading yesterday that something the size of Rhode Island and solar panels put into the Sahara Desert provide all the energy that would be needed to desalinize the Mediterranean. And once you do that, you'd open up enough farmland right there in North Africa with the 350 days of sunshine to actually feed the entire planet. And that could be accomplished for less money that was spent on our military budget in 1 year. So if anybody's ever going hungry, remember, it's because people want to fight wars that we allow to lead, or I should say rule us.
Yeah, dude. We don't need these big giant wars. And, I get it. Human nature, there's always going to be conflicts between people, and there's always going to be fights and arguments. Back in the day, before the idea of agriculture became, the binding ingredient to create big civilizations and cities and city states and all these things, there were wars back then between tribes. And 10 people would die, 20 people would die, maybe 50. And then the tribes would go about their business and they'd figure it out. But nowadays, when these super tribes go to war, especially now, post-World War II, you're not just talking about 100 people or 50 people. I mean, that's just one airstrike nowadays. You're talking about 50 million people or 100 million people or several billion people perishing in a World War III scenario. So we're no longer in that state of mind where people can just say, oh, yeah, we have a disagreement, let's fight. Fine, but when you're talking about super states, a lot of other people that have nothing to do with it are going to be caught up in it. It's wrong. It's not right. It's not right. If one person starts a fight with another person, they fight and they deal with it. Fine. If one person starts a fight with someone else and then a bunch of other people have to die because of it, well, then we start having a big problem. And that's exactly why we need to start building ourselves away from these ideas of cities, of super states and empires and stuff. And then as far as, as we talked about, as far as how do we pay for all the big, projects and stuff to advance humanity, well, we crowdsource them. Instead of taxing people strong arm and throwing them in jail if they don't want to pay it, we crowdsource it. You know what I mean? And let the ideas sell themselves, maybe in a couple hundred years from now, look back and people will look back at this radio show and say, yeah, they kind of had it right back then. But I'll join the chorus of other plenty of other people who have warned that we're in a pretty dangerous state right now because of the state of our technologies and the instability that we're facing and the size of the empires involved. We're in a state now where it's really dangerous, and if we're not careful, a lot of people are going to wind up being affected by it. And you know, all we can do right now is buy our time, survive, and evolve. You know, especially socially and at a civilization standpoint, the way we organize our civilizations, they need to evolve and get better and better and better with the aid of technology and information. You know, it's something that's very possible. And as messed up as the news is today and all the things going on, you know, I'm optimistic for a lot of things like technologies and access to the internet and access to information. These are all things that are going to help us. And maybe the next future generations are going to, you know, be able to benefit from this stuff right now where it's, you know, the internet is a very divisive place at this moment. But in the future, maybe it'll wind up being a tool that is used for the greater good of humanity. Joining us now, we've got our awesome journalist, Jake Anderson. What's up, dude? Jake, you there? I think the ghost of Jake is joining us on the radio show tonight. anyway, let's shift over to what the hell went on in Turkey today. And then there was a couple other, look like some type of coordinated attacks throughout Europe. Like I mentioned, the U.S. embassy was locked down. First of all, Russia's ambassador to Turkey was gunned down in cold blood today. I'm sure most people have heard the story. We covered it on the anti-media. You can see the video there, man. It was pretty nuts that this was caught on video and stuff. And some dude just shot him in the back a couple times, three times, I think. Ben was yelling and screaming about Aleppo and, you know, payback for Aleppo and what Russia has done to Aleppo. And, of course, everyone's familiar with what's going on in Aleppo. But immediately I saw a lot of people talking about how this is like it could be used as like a Franz Ferdinand moment. Those that aren't familiar, this is like the Franz Ferdinand moment is kind of like the one of the events that helped trigger World War One, and it was due to the fact that there was like a bunch of entangling alliances and stuff, and one guy got assassinated, and next thing you know, all the countries in Europe declare war on each other. the thing is, and this is what is very unfortunate, is that we didn't learn our lesson from World War One, or from even some of the founding fathers. One of those guys, Thomas Jefferson, one of them, warning us against entangling alliances, because, again, it goes back to this idea that you get into an alliance with, let's say, France, and then France attacks England, and then they declare war on each other, and then you have to declare war on England. Now, that's exactly what we've done with NATO. And so we're dealing with NATO, and it goes directly into what we're talking about here in Turkey. Turkey's a NATO member. If Turkey starts a war with Russia, I mean, you know, a few months ago when Turkey shot down a Russian jet, everyone was like, holy shit, this is it. You know, if Russia strikes back, we're going to be drawn in, we're going to be at war with Russia. And then who knows if China's going to join them, and you know who knows where the alliances are going to fall. But again, this goes back to what's going on right now with this assassination. Was this a state-sponsored assassination? Was it Turkey purposely assassinating this guy? Was it some other actor, the CIA maybe, assassinating this guy to sow distrust between Turkey and Russia? Was it just some guy that happened to be sympathetic to the rebels in Aleppo that was like, screw it, I'm going to shoot this guy today? Who knows? I mean, it's hard to tell. We don't have any evidence. We just know what happened. We see what happened. There's a bunch of speculation out there. But this is a big, very big deal because, again, Turkey is a NATO member, which means anything they do when it comes to war, it is probably going to affect us. And so we are beholden to their extremely deranged leader who makes Trump look like a moderate. I mean, the guy that's running Turkey right now, for all we know, staged a fake coup and has since basically arrested all of the opposition. They recently just arrested a bunch more Kurdish politicians and stuff after blaming a terrorist attack on some Kurdish terrorists. The guy that's running Turkey right now, Erdogan, the guy is a lunatic. He's quickly becoming a dictator, yet NATO is like fine with it, and we're still tied into a alliance with this guy. So
Nick, what if tonight was about making the Turkish military aware that this Erdogan is not going to have NATO support, and that they're going to just let them have at it with Russia on their own, because it's just not worth it to them for World War III, because the new regime is basically in right now. I mean, the only thing left right now is just 22 days of fluffery, essentially. It's a farewell tour and a book deal lineup, basically, that's left. So the new regime was solidified today. Nothing's going to stop it unless there's martial law, and I think they've already kind of failed at those opportunities. Anything left would be absolute insanity, and yeah, I think that's what's just going on, man. What do you think?
We've got 22 more days of Huffington Post freaking out about Trump. You know, that's what we got to deal with. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. So, you know, all we have to go on right now are basically state reactions to what happened. Russia immediately called it a terrorist attack. They weren't really blaming Turkey. In fact, according to what I've read, Turkey and Russia have already talked about what happened, and they're basically both saying, okay, you know, this is somebody trying to throw a wedge between us and throw a wrench into our latest economic dealings and our talks on Syria. So, you know, this comes at a very interesting time because Aleppo has now fallen. Aleppo was like the Stalingrad of the, of the Syrian uprising or whatever you want to call it. Now that Aleppo has fallen, hopes for the Syrian revolution, the Syrian uprising, or the regime change of Bashar al-Assad, whichever way you want to look at it, hopes are pretty much dashed. I mean, there's already, looking at the remnants of the rebels that are left over, there's so much infighting that they're almost neutralizing themselves at this point. So Aleppo falls, and, you know, Turkey and Russia are trying to negotiate the ceasefire and, you know, the evacuation of both civilians and rebels and all that stuff. And then this guy comes out and tries to throw a wrench in it by assassinating the ambassador. And that's pretty much where Russia and Turkey stand on this, is that they're like, okay, we're not going to let this assassination get in the way of this. So, you know, for all we know, you know, who knows who the actors were behind this, but it definitely seems like Turkey and Russia are taking it as a ploy to divide them, and it looks like they're not going to let it happen. So at this point, it seems like maybe this ambassador was killed, and it's really sad that it happened. And it's you know, ambassadors are supposed to be people that don't get killed. And, you know, of course, the U.S. has freaked out about our ambassador that got killed in Benghazi and stuff like that. You know, ambassadors are diplomatic people. They're supposed to have diplomatic immunity. They're not supposed to be subject to violence, no matter how bad countries hate each other. The diplomatic people are supposed to be immune because they're trying to be, you know, in theory, they're there trying to make peace or trying to cut deals and, you know, increase relations and that kind of thing. So ambassadors are supposed to be safe from violence. You know, and so it's always a really bad situation when a diplomat gets killed or kidnapped or whatever happens. But from what I can tell right now, there aren't going to be any super serious repercussions from this, because it looks like Turkey and Russia are just like, you know what, someone is trying to mess with our shit. We're not going to let it get in our way. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that Turkey and Russia just inked a huge pipeline deal. And if you look back, if you've been following our coverage and what we've been talking about with the Syrian war, a lot of that stems from a pipeline deal that there's two separate pipeline pipeline plans that were competing against each other. One involved like the Russian, Syrian, Iranian alliance. The other involved the Saudi Arabian, Qatari, Turkish alliance. And it seemed like once the Syrian government said, okay, we're not going to go with the Saudi Arabia, Qatar pipeline, we're going to go with the Iranian one, all of a sudden that's when the Syrian uprising started. And now that Russia has involved itself in the Syrian war, and obviously, as I mentioned, Aleppo has now fallen, the hopes for regime change in Syria are pretty much gone. Well, Turkey saw the writing on the wall a couple months ago, and they inked a big pipeline deal with Russia instead. You know, and so Russia and Turkey are now working relatively close together, even after the jet got shot down and all that stuff. They've mended their ties. And so, you know, to me, it looks like there's not going to be any big geopolitical repercussions. I think we're joined by Jake now. Jake, you on the line? I'm having a problem connecting with Jake. I don't know.
Hey, Jake pissed off the wrong Russians.
Jake's in Moscow right now, and he can't get a good internet connection, apparently.
Use Snowden.
Anyway, but that being said, we're going to have to watch this really closely over the next couple of days, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about it on Wednesday, because we don't know what the fallout's going to be. I saw Putin was calling for, you know, an investigation to see what happened and stuff. So we're going to have to wait and see what comes out, the details. Of course, if this thing had been geopolitically motivated and it wasn't just some random cop that lost his shit and just shot the guy, there's going to be a bunch of propaganda that comes out, and we're going to have to try to sort through it all. And that's one of the big problems with trying to sort out what's going on in Syria, because literally everything that comes out of Syria at this point is propaganda. Aleppo is not safe for journalists. There's no, there are very, very, very few journalists in Aleppo, in the rebel side of Aleppo, at least what was the rebel side of Aleppo, because they're all getting killed or kidnapped. So the reporting coming out of there is based on secondhand accounts that stem basically from the rebels or from the Assad government. So we don't know. You know, the Assad government tells us one thing, because they're, you know, fighting against these guys. The rebels tell us the other thing, because the rebels are fighting against the government. The truth is probably somewhere in between, but we don't know what the truth is, because nobody knows. Now, has that stopped the mainstream media from covering Aleppo like 24 hours a day and telling us every single thing the rebels want us to hear? The mainstream media is regurgitating that stuff. It's fake news. It's fake news. There's no other way to put it. Because it can't be confirmed. You can't confirm something that some rebel is telling you, because who's there to dispute that his story? Who's going to tell you any otherwise? Nobody. For all we know, it's a genocide, and 10 million people are dead in Aleppo, even though the city only has a couple hundred thousand people living in it. For all we know, that's how the media coverage has been. Now, what I want to know is, where is the media coverage on Mosul? Mosul is a city of what once was 1.5 million people. It was captured by ISIS back in 2014. The Iraqi army abandoned the city because they were overrun quickly. Maybe, first of all, because they were scared of ISIS. Second of all, because the population had probably turned on them. How else do you lose a city that big that quickly with only 10,000 guys fighting against you? I don't know. But the siege in Mosul has now forced 100,000 people out of their homes. Eastern Aleppo only had 250,000 people in the whole city. 100,000 people have fled their homes in Mosul ever since the U.S.-backed operation to retake it started. Where's the media coverage on that? New York Times covers Aleppo every day. Where's their coverage on Mosul? You know what I mean? I mean, we're doing the same exact thing that Russia and Syria were doing to Aleppo. We're doing that right now in Mosul, but the media coverage tells us that we're liberating that city, that we're helping them, and that anytime civilians die, I shit you not, go on Google right now and Google human shields in Mosul. Go Google that, and you'll see three CNN links saying that the civilians dying in Mosul are because ISIS is using them as human shields. Doesn't say anything about U.S. bombs dropping and killing them. Doesn't say, oh, damn, we accidentally killed this many civilians today. Doesn't say that. It says ISIS is using them as human shields. Now, if you look back at the rhetoric, you'll remember that that's the same exact language they use whenever Israel bombs Palestine or the Gaza Strip. They say, oh, Israel's not killing civilians. It's because the Palestinians are using themselves as human shields. This is the same language that they're using for Mosul. You know, and so there's just an extreme hypocrisy in the media coverage where, on one hand, Aleppo is under siege by the government and they're trying to take it back from what they call terrorists. And it's like, it's a genocide, it's a slaughter, and Russia is so wrong, the Syrian government is so wrong, but it's because we're not their allies and because we're backing the Syrian rebels. But in Aleppo, in Mosul, we're sieging that city, we're calling them terrorists, but every bomb that we drop is a good bomb. Every family that's blown up over there was because of ISIS, not because of us. You know, 100,000 people fleeing their homes, not our fault, ISIS's fault. You know, major hypocrisy there. I'm actually going to be trying to write about that tomorrow. It's just so hard to get information out of Mosul because literally everything that comes out of Mosul is either ISIS propaganda or regurgitating U.S. talking points. That's it. That's all there is. How do I find the truth of it? It's hard to find.
Well, when you do, you go to like Vanessa Beatley or other people that were on the ground over there, and they say it's completely different than everything that we've been told. So, yeah, Nick, what's going on in Mosul? What's also going on in Yemen? I mean, we just shipped a huge arms deal over there, and you don't hear anything about it. And I think with the change in the regime going on, that I think Saudi Arabia realizes these shipments, that was probably the last one, and they ought to keep it for the impending Iranian invasion.
A whole nother thing, Yemen. What in the hell is going on in Yemen? We're not even...
Well, we left Saudi Arabia. We left them to hang out to dry because we don't need oil anymore. That's what DAPL is all about. We're gonna frack our way to independence, and then we're going to tell them to stick it. And let Iran just take them over. And we'll deal with the Persian Empire again, I guess.
Has Yemen ceased to exist? I mean, according to the U.S. media, Yemen no longer is an issue. Except for the fact that there's a child dying once every 10 minutes there. Because of the U.S.-backed siege on the entire country. What Russia is doing to Aleppo is shameful. But we're doing that to a whole country right now in Yemen. Bad. Really bad. And the U.S. just announced that they were cutting off part of an arms deal to Yemen, but they never announced that they were going to stop supporting that incursion because we're materially, intelligence, you know, infrastructure, we're supporting what's going on with the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. It's genocide there. It's genocide. Children are starving. It's the poorest country in the world, and it's gotten even worse. They're bombing their farms. They're bombing their food storage. They're bombing their water systems in Yemen. And you know what? We're paying for it. All of us, you, me, Jake, everyone listening that lives within the United States tonight, we're paying for that stuff. We're paying for it to happen. We're paying for a child to starve every 10 minutes. We're not sending them food. We're sending them bombs, and it's heartbreaking, man. It really is. And the media coverage is shameful. You actually have to go out and like search out. Like, you want to know what's going on in Yemen? You got to go search it out every morning. You want to know what's going on in Mosul? You got to go search it out. Anyway, thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back Wednesday. Anthony Media Radio. I'ma let them know through the stereo. Yo, here we go through the stereo.